and just making it in time. Mark Kermo, good afternoon.
I lead a breathless life.
You do. And you miss Tom Wilkinson, who...
Which I'm quite sad about, actually.
He's a nice bloke.
He's a very fine actor. He was in a documentary that I made about the Full Monty a while ago. I say that only in passing.
Jeff Marchant on this email says, I saw a good woman at a mystery preview on Monday. Despite his comments about Star Wars being dull, do you see how he moved from one to the other? And even, can I just say again, this is not our Star Wars day.
It doesn't open until next week.
Okay, it opens on Thursday.
You know.
Despite his recent comments about Star Wars being dull, I have to say Tom completely steals the show in A Good Woman, and his performances just get better every time I see him. He says, P.S., I don't care what Kermit has to say about Episode 3 either. I have a ticket for next Wednesday at 30:30, and I can't wait. Thank you, Jeff.
30:30.
And this from... This from John. Okay, another email.
I saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 at 30:30.
On the subject of... Episode 3. John says, terrible film, boring, predictable, with wooden acting, too much reliance on CGI, overhyped, predictable reliance on marketing and burger sales, and they all mumble their lines, going back to last week's theme. Actually, he says, I haven't seen it.
Oh, is he just guessing?
He's just guessing. He said, I've got to go and see it next week with the kids. And then he says, sneaking in with a can of lager, you cough when opening. I think that's quite good. A review without having seen it. If you want to send in your Star Wars review without having seen it, you can do it. Mayo@bbc.co.uk.
Shamefully, in the way that British film criticism is going, he would not be the first film critic to do that.
Okay. Well, you know, if you want to send in a review without having seen it, feel free. This week's movies, Monster in Law, Friday Night Lights, The Jacket, Ong Bak. Seed of Chucky, oh dear.
But hey, excuse me, it's about prejudging films. Seed of Chucky, oh dear.
It's got Chucky in it, I'm not interested.
It's got Jennifer Tilly in it.
The last horror movie, and A Good Woman, actually, and you missed Tom, but we'll get your thoughts on A Good Woman in just a moment. Oh, do the box office top 10, I would thought first of all, it would be polite. Robots hanging in at 10.
I like it, well designed, and I think we've said pastel shades enough times. Anyway, it's out now, isn't it? It's 10 this week, so it'll be gone next week.
Sahara at 9.
You don't need to bother.
Valiant at 8.
You know, I'm still amazed at how well that film's done. Just goes to show that, you know, probably there is a market for it. I thought it was not as good as it should have been.
Guess Who at 7.
Not as bad as it should have been, astonishingly enough.
The Amityville Horror at 6.
Go and get the original. It's on DVD. If you really have to, but you don't really have to. Like I said, the best thing to do is a very good book about the, I think it's called The Amityville Conspiracy, all about how everyone involved in it ended up suing everybody else. There's nothing supernatural about it. It's just big lawyer's fees, and that's quite a good read.
Number 5 is The Interpreter.
You know, famous actors overacting and mumbling. I think didn't we say that was up with the top mumbling?
It was one of the top mumblers.
Sean Penn mumbling his way through it. It's fine, but it's just a genre movie dressed up as an art film.
Wedding Gate, number 4.
Wedding Date? Did you say Wedding Gate?
That's what I've got here.
Yeah, well, I think you'll find it's The Wedding Date.
You mean you haven't seen The Wedding Gate? It's a follow-on to Stargate.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where they all marry aliens.
Okay, Stargate, which we interviewed the leading man for, James Dull Spader, wasn't he?
It was such a bad interview and so boring, never put it out.
Yeah, yeah. It's not such a bad film, but he was up there with Val, Dull, Bore Me Senseless, Kilmer.
The Wedding Gate just picks up where Stargate...
It does, yeah. The Wedding Gate may be great, The Wedding Date is a stinker.
XXX² at number 3.
Oh, yeah, various different titles. Well, The Next Level or, you know, State of the Union, if you see it in America. I mean, rubbish, obviously, but Ice Cube sort of stepping into the shoes left vacant by Vin Diesel. And didn't you say there's something about Vin Diesel coming back for XXX?
According to our correspondence, he's back for the next one.
I mean, you know, I don't understand how, because they kill him off. I mean, by phone, they kill him off, because somebody says, hey, you know, that guy got killed, but... So, yeah, I don't think that
it's the wrong number.
Narrative, yeah, exactly. It's the wrong guy. It'll be somebody else.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, no longer number 1, down to number 2.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that it didn't hold its spot at number 1. That said, it has done better than I thought it was going to do, and my impression is that it has played better to people who were not great fans of the original and who didn't have expectations of it, which were defined largely by being in love with the book and the radio show and the record and T-shirt and towel and all that stuff. I was in love with all of those things, I admit this quite frankly, and there was a lot missing for me in that film. But people who are hitchhiking virgins seem to have enjoyed it a lot more.
And the box office number 1 in the UK this week is Kingdom of Heaven. 7.
So interesting that it's done that. I mean, obviously, it had a massive advertising campaign behind it. It'll be very interesting to see how it holds up. I think it's fatally flawed. But as I said last week, despite everything that's wrong with it, and boy, there's a lot wrong with it, most of all, Orlando Bloom, who really does not look like a crusading giant at all, just looks like Orlando Bloom having a bit of a tiff. Go and see it because it's a new Ridley Scott film that's got a lot of stuff that needs to be discussed. And I wouldn't want to put anyone off seeing it, but I have to say I was bored for long sections of it. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it is possible to watch films and not all the time have your ribs tickled or your heart aflutter or your brain titillated. It is possible to watch a film and think, actually, this isn't working, but I'm still glad I'm watching it.
Shall we start with Scarlett Johansson?
Can I just say,
Mr. Wilkinson?
After all that time of me saying it's Johansson, and you always saying, I was right, and there's from a man who knew her.
Well, I'll take it from...
Worked with her.
I know, so therefore I'll take it.
Yeah, so Scarlett Johansson.
I'll take it from Tom.
As I think I said. Well, you've seen the film as well.
Yep.
It's an adaptation of an Oscar Wilde. I mean, Tom Wilkinson is the best thing in the film by quite a long way. His performance is good and ripe and ribald, and the thing that I like about his performance is that he does manage to get a sense of... you know, the decrepitude in the wild. I mean, I have to say, I think it's fairly pedestrian stuff. It's visually quite nice to look at, and there's a lot of, you know, there's nicely lit settings.
Well, it's the Amalfi Coast.
Yeah, but the problem is I don't actually know that serves the wild text, which has been very, you know, very heavily rewritten very well. In the end, it was fairly inconsequential. It's not bad, it's just not very... It's certainly not one of the best Oscar Wilde adaptations. It was just, it felt a little bit perfunctory to me. Wilkinson was good. Helen Hunt, who I'm a great fan of, God bless her for effectively making herself look like she's about 60, because Helen Hunt is a fantastic looking woman, and she's deliberately sort of allowed herself to be made up in a way that makes her look clearly older than she is. And you find me another actress, you know, of her stature who would happily do that. So I think she's great.
And it's a fairly rotten part.
It is.
As much as she's playing someone with not many redeeming features.
Yes, but in fact, the dynamic between her and Wilkinson is actually the key to the movie. And actually, all those scenes, the scenes between them, I would happily have had. The stuff with Scarlett Johansson and the idiot husband and the stuff, I'm not that bothered by. And, you know, there are a few of the off-the-cuff Wildeanisms. But they're fine. But I would much rather have had a movie of half the length which just consisted of Helen Hunt and Tom Wilkinson and didn't even have all those settings, had just the two of them together. See it as a two-hander. Obviously, that would be a different film, sadly.
That's true. Can I just ask, from an industry point of view, will there be a number of movie... houses who are thinking, we've got to get everything out because, you know, we can't put anything decent out next week because it'll just get blown away?
Well, it's a weird thing. It's certainly, I mean, there's so many things out this week, and whenever a big blockbuster looms on the horizon, and whatever, you know, one's judgment on it is, and I'll keep my powder dry.
Although other people are sending in their reviews without having
seen it. And some of them are writing for national newspapers. I think that it's generally, there's one or two ways of doing it. Either you get everything out of the way before Star Wars, or you do something called counter-programming. And counter-programming is you put up a movie against Star Wars that is so completely opposite, there's not even a fight. So it's not like, for example, there's this weird thing coming out called What the Bleep Do We Know, which is a documentary about quantum physics. And presumably it's going out alongside Star Wars for those people who say, I don't want to see a movie with Jar Jar Binks in it, albeit for only 2 seconds.
Powder is getting damp.
How far away from it can I get? I'll go and see that. So there is, it's called counter-programming, okay. And sometimes it works.
It's very difficult to avoid the subject, really, isn't it?
It is. But you've seen...
I've seen it, but titillate us with something out this week.
Do you want me to titillate you with any more about Star Wars? With Star Wars until next week.
Who knows where the conversation's going to go, but give us a proper, decent review from a movie you've seen.
Let's quickly do Ong Bak. And can I just stress, incidentally, for the record, never, never, never review a movie you haven't seen. Never, never, never. Critics. If you do, you're bad and evil and wrong. Let's start off in that case with The Jacket. I had low expectations.
You said we're going to do Ong Bak?
Yeah, but I've just changed my mind.
Okay, The Jacket.
Let's start off. Do you want to do Ong Bak first?
Let's do The Jacket.
No, let's do Ong Bak now that we've got that. Okay, so Ong Bak is a martial arts movie.
Why don't you do the last horror movie?
No, let's do Ong Bak quickly. Okay, so Ong Bak is a martial arts movie with this new guy who's considered to be, you know, the great new breaking star who's going to basically take over from Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee. And what he does is pretty much all of his own stunts. And the story is, at the beginning of the movie, his village has a deity stolen from them. He has to go and get the deity back. He's a semi-religious character who's on his way to becoming a monk. But sadly, you've all seen Kung Fu. You know how these things work. He's a monk. He's going to be a monk. He has all these special powers, but he's not allowed to use them. But sadly, he then ends up in a kind of bare-knuckle boxing arena in which, in order not to die, he has to use his powers. You remember how it used to work with David Carradine? He'd spend 25 minutes saying, "Ah, the tree that does not bend will break, and I must know." And then suddenly, the last time, he'd kick the hell out of everybody.
Which is what you've been waiting for.
Exactly.
You cut to the chase.
Well, in Ong Bak, it takes him about 20 minutes to get to the actual punch-ups. It starts with a fantastic sequence in which all these rival guys from the village chase each other up a tree. And they appear to be doing this completely barefoot and without the aid of safety nets. And they chase each other up a tree and throw each other. And people fall down on the floor and bang their heads and backs. And it looks like people probably got really badly hurt. And I do believe that actually during the making of Ong Bak, people did get very badly hurt. Anyway, the rest of the plot then consists of him going around, getting into increasingly big fights, attempting only to retrieve the head of the deity which has been stolen from his village so that he can give it back to his village so that they can celebrate Ong Bak successfully with their deity returned. There are great punch-ups. There are great chase sequences with those little three-wheeler motorized bikes flying off the edge of half-built road superstructures. There are sequences in which, as people are running down a road, people literally start walking out in front of them with sheets of glass and big bolt. You remember that sequence in Wayne's World? Wayne's World 2, when there's a whole sequence where all the people in the village have to get all the bowls of fruit out onto the street and all the paint so that when the chase comes through, everything flies around and then the guy at the end of it says, "Our job here is done." Well, it's like that, only more head-cracking. There's been a big wait to see this new version of Ong Bak because it's been doing the rounds with an old soundtrack. But the version that we saw it with, which was last Friday, has got a new soundtrack. Now, I have to say, the soundtrack didn't jump out at me and say, this has suddenly revolutionised the film. There are longers. It does take quite a long time to get going. I think it could possibly have been trimmed down by about 15 minutes. But for Jackie Chan-style stunt work and throwing... I don't know whether this guy's going to be a huge star internationally. I suspect maybe not, because at the moment he's not the greatest actor in the world, but just to see physical action like that, Ong Bak does deliver. It does deliver, the sucker punch that the poster says it delivers, and it is basically a film of people kicking each other in the head in exciting and interesting ways.
This from Martin in Old Portsmouth about Ong Bak. Mm. What is it with the new wave of martial arts films? For years they were derided as clunky, chop-socky pulp tripe.
Which they are.
And yet they've mysteriously now metamorphosized into visual poems, allegorical metaphors of a forgotten time, hypnotic examples of the cinematographer's art, and all the other old cobblers that film critics come out with when they've been drinking the printer toner again.
Well, I'm not making any of those claims about Ong Bak, and of course it's interesting if you put Ong Bak next to, for example, House of Flying Daggers or any of those movies which are now being hailed as great works of art. Ong Bak isn't a great work of art. It is an exploitation movie, and actually what I quite like about it is that's what it is. It is a chop-socky exploitation movie aimed solely at the grindhouse market. You're not going to watch it and get some great spiritual fulfillment out of it. You're going to watch it and get a little bit of plot, a little bit of humour, and basically about 45 minutes of people kicking each other in the head. And that's fine, because that's what it is.
And then he says, "And I bet Star Wars 3 is Bobbins. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, in my ear." It's what he says. If you want to review it without seeing it, mail@bbc.co.uk, and we'll take your emails between now and 4 o'clock. Movie reviews to come. You can text 85058331. Some of your emails here, Sam English, lots of people reviewing Star Wars without having seen it. It's just a bit of prejudgment, which we all do. Sam says...
Some of us do.
"I haven't seen it yet, but I imagine my review will look something like this. The best of the prequels, still rubbish." James from Hammersmith.
Unerringly accurate.
James from... Keep that powder
dry.
It's becoming moist. On the subject of Star Wars and quantum mechanics... Yeah, counter-programming, Mark. Sorry, but for the sort of person...
The
sort of person who would go to see Star Wars, brackets, better than expected, without having seen it, is exactly the sort of person that would want to watch a documentary about quantum mechanics. Smart counter-programming would be a re-release of Sense and Sensibility or a film about flowers or something. Mm. David is poised with an email.
Adrian in Ireland says, on the subject of Return of the Sith, "I don't want...
Revenge of the Sith,
or whatever
Return of the Jedi, Revenge of the Sith. Even I know this."
Thank you. Well, you are the film critic. You should.
Actually, good point. Yeah. Good point. Well made.
Either way, Adrian says he doesn't want to spoil it for anyone, but he suspects that Anakin goes over to the dark side and changes his name by deed poll to Darth Vader. Princess Amidala gives birth to twins and then carks it. Yoda gets his sentences the wrong way round, and Obi-Wan Kenobi survives to fight another day. Not many surprises there, then.
And this text says... Of course it's predictable, it's a prequel.
Hang on, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me was a prequel, but that wasn't predictable at all.
It was Twin Peaks.
Yeah, but We can't judge everything by David Lynch's standards. Exactly. I'd like to see David Lynch get his hand on a Star Wars movie.
Text 85058. Terry Gilliam would have been good.
Yeah, he would have been.
Can I just say, for all those sad 30-somethings out there, like myself, who've been waiting 20-odd years for this defining moment in cinematic history, take up your lightsabers, go and see the film, and just go in the back of the cinema.
But I remember just before Phantom Menace came out, Phil Jupiter's met me on the street and said, he said, this Star Wars thing is happening. He said, somebody came up to me and whispered, have you seen the trailer? Have you... Double-ended lightsabers. And he was that excited.
Exactly.
There are quadruple-ended lightsabers coming
up.
David, thank you. Michael, on this, I went to see Kingdom of Heaven 2 days ago, fell asleep after 20 minutes, and unfortunately woke up with 10 minutes to go. Enough of that already. What else is new?
The Jacket, the new movie by multimedia artist John Mabry, whose most recent feature, Love is the Devil, was widely acclaimed. I have to say, I didn't have high expectations on the basis of the poster and the preview campaign. The poster is a poster which makes it look like a kind of post-Seven thriller. And it's described by John Mabry as a sort of genreless film. I never trust people who say that films are genreless because I love genre films, and it seems to me that whenever people say, it doesn't have a genre, they're saying that they're above the genre somehow. It's not a thriller, it's not a horror movie, it's something else, maybe it's a hybrid. But actually, there's nothing wrong with genre. Genre is a great thing, people should just admit to it. Anyway, The Jacket, which is described as a genreless movie, but actually, for me, is a sort of sci-fi horror hybrid, draws inspiration from movies which I really like. Jacob's Ladder, which I'm a really big fan of, the Adrian Lyne movie, which is very, very widely overlooked, in which all the events take place in the mind of a dying soldier. And Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys, which, of course, is basically a reworking of La Jetée, which is a terrific little short by Chris Marker. So time travel, psychological horror, breakdown of the past and present and future. Adrian Brody stars as a soldier who, in the first Gulf War, is wounded and left for dead, but then comes back from the dead. Then back in America, is wounded a second time, in an event in which he is accused of murder. He is then sent to an asylum where the treatment dished out by Kris Kristofferson as the mad doctor, and few people do mad doctors more grizzledly than Kris Kristofferson, who is a great actor. I mean, he only does one role, but boy, does he do it well. It's like a sensory deprivation chamber. They put the patient in a straitjacket and stick him on a mortician's slab, you know, in one of the ones where they put in like a filing cabinet, and they leave them in there. They leave them in there to hallucinate. In this clip, which is about as explanatory as any clip gets, Adrian Brody discusses with another inmate what happens when they are in the jacket.
I know that they take you down there. I know that they put you in it. The rest of it, it's a trip. You know, it's like a serious vacation.
If I know, I'm gonna die.
Well, mortality is actually a great thing to be familiar with.
I'm gonna die in 4 days.
Oh.
This is what I found out. You can find my body in 4 days.
What are you two yapping about?
We're talking about our ability to go forward in time, to go into the future. And that's what we're talking about, right?
If you need to find something out when you're in there, just calm down. The less you freak, the less you'll trip out.
Yeah, but all this.
Now, the other movies that it alludes to, at least references that I thought I spotted, obviously there's a bit of George Sly's The Vanishing. If you've got a thing about claustrophobia and being shut in dark spaces, then you're going to have a ball. There are, you know, certain nods to movies like, for example, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which, again, the action takes place.
In which Tom Wilkinson was in.
And he's fantastic. And, of course, as we know, that was the best movie of... It was last year, wasn't it? Yeah, and an absolutely wonderful piece of work. I read today that The Jacket has got kind of fairly sniffy reviews in the broadsheets, and people... I generally think that people take against it. The people who take against The Jacket are people who take against genre movies, people who take against sci-fi, horror, thrillers, that sort of thing, because they kind of feel they're above them. Now, for me, one of the greatest directors living today is David Cronenberg, and David Cronenberg is a genre director. The thing with what John Mabry has done is, because John Mabry comes out of an avant-garde tradition, because he's, you know, he does installations and he does video artwork, he directed that video for Nothing Compares to You, you know, in which Sinead O'Connor famously cried. So he's a visual artiste, but not like Tracy Emin, who's a visual artiste, but has, you know, made a film which is an execrable piece of old twaddle, which I think never even got released in the end because it was so terrible. But I did see it, but it was really awful. It was only 61 minutes long, which is, incidentally, the same running time as Deep Throat, but I mentioned that only in passing. Anyway.
Why?
Because it's just interesting that the last movie I can remember that was 61 minutes long. Oh, nine songs as well. There's a common thread in all of those things. What John Mabry brings to it is an avant-garde sensibility, and generally I'm not a particularly pro-avant-garde kind of guy. But what's nice about this is that it has a script which kind of works like a watch spring. It's a beautifully elliptical, sort of self-referential, cyclical, time-travelling story in which all the pieces of the puzzle slowly fall into place as the puzzle plays out. It's very emotionally involving. It has a lovely ending, and I have to confess that I shed a tear at the end. I thought the end was moving and touching, and one of the reasons for that is that although there are these flashes of sort of avant-garde sensibility which are used when Adrian Brody, the central character, goes into his dream states, I mean, I think it also refers, for example, to Ken Russell's film Altered States, which is a great and underrated movie. The main pyrotechnics come from Adrian Brody's face. There are few actors that look as put upon as Adrian Brody. I mean, he genuinely does look like somebody who is fragile and has been downtrodden by the world, and I think he gives a great performance. Chris Christopherson's great. Jennifer Jason Leigh is always reliably haggard, and she's very reliable and very haggard in
this.
Nick
Nolte does haggard and put upon.
Yeah, but Nick Nolte does gruff in a way. You know, that's the thing. Chris Christopherson doesn't mumble. Nick Nolte does mumble, and I wish he'd stop doing it, but Chris Christopherson just talks with a kind of gruff voice, and he looks grizzled. The only weak link in the chain, I think, is Keira Knightley. And Keira Knightley is actually a perfectly fine actress. She was very good in Bend It Like Beckham. Obviously, since then, she's become a big Hollywood star with things like Pirates of the Caribbean, which, as you know, I'm not a big fan of. But I still think that she's a good actress. I think she's slightly miscast in the lead role in this, and she very much plays a part which is the counterpart to Kate Winslet's role in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and I don't think she quite pulls it off. But hats off to her for having the chutzpah to actually go and do a role like this rather than just follow more and more Hollywood blockbuster roles, which I'm sure she could. I'm sure Jerry Bruckheimer would employ her from here until doomsday on the basis of what a sort of hot Hollywood star she is. I was really surprised. Don't be put off by the snotty broadsheet reviews. The Jacket is a really interesting piece of work. It's not original. Like I said, it does refer to several films that I like. If you like Donnie Darko, it's in that same kind of area. But I thought it had something special, and like I said, I did cry at the end.
But you cry at most.
No, that's not true. That's now become.
You cry easily.
No, I cry if a film is emotional. I have no shame about crying. I think, you know, people should cry in movies in the same way as they should laugh or they should shriek. You know, I have no problem with bodily responses to movies, and a lot of people do.
Is that right?
That is right.
Kay Smith says, yes, Mark, Jacob's Ladder automatically sprung to mind when I heard about The Jacket. I have to agree with you.
Good.
Jacob's Ladder, totally underrated.
And a great film, easily Adrian Lyne's best film.
And on the subject of David Lynch, a number of people, including Gail and Tom, on these emails saying David Lynch was offered Return of the Jedi but turned it down.
Is that right?
And did Dune.
Did Dune, as the Americans say.
He was offered it. Well. And this... Friends
is
in
that
high-
right? Well, you know, there we go.
Friends in High Places here. This is Andrew Reynolds, Associate Professor, Department of Political Science, University of North Carolina.
Yoinks.
I'm a Brit. Simon has been exiled to the States for quite a while, but I've become addicted to listening to Five Live, especially Mark and his terrific movie reviews, blaring out from my office through the internet. I'm trying to get the surrounding Americans to hear so that they stop producing such rubbish movies. And then he says... different subject. And another thing, it's so funny. They have no idea how much trouble they've got into by allowing George Galloway to come over. So that's next Tuesday, which we await with interest. 3:47. So there's a whole stack of stuff to get through.
There is. Let's try and bracket some things together. On the horror front, let's do Seed of Chucky and The Last Horror Movie. Now, The Last Horror Movie comes at you with a poster with a number of quotes from people whose opinions I respect, one of them being Alan Jones, who, of course, is a friend of this show who's been on it times that I've been off, who's a great horror film critic, and he said that it was the best British horror movie of the year. And the story is, funnily enough, it's designed
to... strong competition for that post?
Well, yeah, I think he's wrong anyway, even though there isn't strong competition. You start watching the movie, it starts out like a slasher film, then suddenly the screen fuzzes and a face comes on, and it's the face of a guy who says, hey, I'm a serial killer, now watch my video that I've made of me killing all these people because you're a horror film fan and, you know, that's the kind of thing that you like. So it's one of those kind of Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, Man Bites Dog, all those movies that we've all seen a billion times before, but done in Britain. The central gag is you're meant to have rented a horror movie on tape and got it home, and actually what's been recorded over it is the last horror movie.
Well, delightful.
Yeah, well, firstly, big mistake, they put it in the cinema. Of course, it don't work in the cinema because you can't record over celluloid, at least not the last time I looked. So that's a problem. However, I saw it at home anyway on tape because it was going to be released just before Christmas, and I thought it was rubbish, actually. It's one of those things in which it's terribly arch. It's terribly full of itself. It's like being lectured for an hour. It's all this stuff about, you know, oh, well, you know, you're the viewer and you're complicit in all this and this is what you want. And I think that, hang on a minute. You know, I'm sorry. I am fed up of being told off by filmmakers. I am particularly fed up of being told off by horror filmmakers. I mean, one of the reasons I don't like Michael Haneke's Funny Games is it's like, it's all very well for an Austrian professor to sit there telling me how evil it is to watch horror films. I don't need to hear this stuff. So go away and get a life. Now, in the case of the last horror movie, this I must concede, it has done very well at the Fright Fest festivals, which are horror film festivals packed with fans. And apparently when they took it on national tour, every time they played it, it was a storm, it was a hoot, everyone loved it. Sorry, I don't get it. All, you know, other friends of mine who are genre fans like it very much. I thought it was increasingly annoying, quite badly made, and derivative in a way which, unlike, for example, The Jacket, didn't take ideas and do something new with them, just recycle them. It may be that I am just sick of seeing this film, because I have seen this film, this gag, this idea, done so many times, and better. But as I said, I am actually, in this case, in a minority, even amongst horror fans. Same time,
they're not doctorates. They haven't got doctorates.
No,
in
no, but you know, Alan
though.
Jones and Nigel Floyd are two people whose judgment on these things I would take my hat off to, and they both like it very much. So just, you know, I have to say in this case, they're wrong. There we go.
Of course.
And I have explained
this.
If I
wanted their opinion, I'd ask them.
You would have asked
them.
Yeah. Okay, so it's not good. Also out this week, Seed of Chucky. Now, this is now the fifth Chucky movie. And you remember the Child's Play series? Child's Play 1, 2, and 3. 1 and 2 were theatrical. 3 went straight to video. 3 became embroiled in a hideous video, Nasty Scare, in 1994, in which it was effectively accused of inspiring a terrible crime. There was the 1994 Public Amendment, Public Order Act, Amendment to the Public Order Act, which actually bolstered up the Video Recordings Act in 1994. So it was seen to be a big thing. Whole series went off for a while, then came back in 1998. Ronnie Yu made a film called Bride of Chucky, which was really funny, really intelligent, really smart, really snappy, in which Jennifer Tilly became the bride of the Chucky doll, which is, of course, possessed by the spirit of the serial killer. His name I can't even remember, but he's played
by... Why did she want to marry a doll?
She didn't want to marry a doll. Oh. You don't want to marry Chucky. It don't work like that, okay? Chucky is, you know...
Thanks for getting me up to speed.
Okay, fine. So now Seed of Chucky, which is directed by Don Mancini, who was one of the original creators of the Chucky series. And again, Jennifer Tilly is back, and in this, which is basically a rehash of Wes Craven's New Nightmare, the story is Jennifer Tilly plays herself. She plays herself as an actress who was once Oscar nominated but is now reduced to playing roles in which she's a doll, and then the dolls come back to haunt her, and she has to decide, you know, how best to proceed when she is about to become the mother of the seed of Chucky. There are cameos from the likes of John Waters, the famous trash filmmaker who made Pink Flamingos and Desperate Living and Female Trouble and all those films, which I'm sure you've managed to avoid, but he also made Hairspray and Cry Baby, which you might have seen. No.
Hairspray.
Hairspray, fine, okay. Well, he made them as well. And he plays a paparazzo who gets killed in a horrible manner. And there's loads and loads of sort of quite jolly, awfully type gore, you know, disembowelings, decapitations, all that sort of stuff, which is absolutely fine. There's some rude humour with Fangoria, and there's loads and loads of very sweary, rude, rank dialogue. And sadly, it all falls flat because Don Mancini, bless him, can't direct. And it does demonstrate what a brilliant job Ronnie Yu did with reinventing the Chucky series, because, you know, Bride of Chucky really was one of the best films of that year. John Waters thought it was the best film of 98. It was definitely one of the best films. And Seed of Chucky is a disappointment. There are some rank gags in it. Should we hear a quick, do you want a quick clip? Yeah, go on. I think you do. Okay, so here's a little clip of Seed of Chucky with Jennifer Tilly.
Well, there must be something I'm right for. Let's see. Hip-hop superstar turned director Redman is still looking for the right actress to take the female lead in his upcoming Bible epic.
Well, that sounds good. What's the role?
Virgin Mary.
What's so funny?
Nothing.
It's perfect. It's just what I need to reinvent myself. The Virgin Mary. I always loved the way she wore robes and her hair off her face, kind of like this. Joe, get Morty on the phone and tell him I need to take a meeting with this red man right away.
Okay.
And that's pretty much as funny as it gets in the broadcastable bits. But the best gag in the movie, Actually, no, I won't tell you. The best gag in the movie is a Shining gag, but it's not a Shining gag, and I won't tell you, because if you go and see it, I don't want to spoil it for you. There's really no reason to go and see it, because there's about five gags in total, and none of them are as funny as the film should be, but God bless Jennifer Tilly. There is something really impressive about seeing an actress, and she's a great actress, and she's brilliant in Bound. If you've never seen Bound, which is the best neo-noir lesbian thriller of the decade, by a mile.
It's a
big genre.
Is it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And she's really, really great in it. And she makes lots of gags about her reputation from Bound in Seed of Chucky. But the film itself isn't any good. And it's largely because Don Mancini can't direct. But he can write. Only he doesn't write brilliantly here. But there we go. Okay, two other films to deal with. Monster-in-Law and Friday Night Lights. Do you have a preference which one I do first?
It's entirely up to you.
Okay, let's quickly do Monster-in-Law in that case. Jane Fonda back on the screen. Hasn't been on the screen for a long time. Over 10 years, I think. Maybe 15 years. Brought back to co-star with Jennifer Lopez. I mean, you know, I just...
What was that?
I just really want to have been in the agent's meeting when the agent said, Jane, we want you to come back to the screen to co-star with Jennifer Lopez, who you'll remember her last few movies, you know, Made in Manhattan and that thing with, you know, that Bennifer abomination. You know, I mean, seriously, as career killers go, co-starring in a movie with Jennifer Lopez, J-Lo to her friends, is not a good one. Anyway, so the story is Jennifer Lopez is this down-at-heel person, don't believe it already, and she falls in love with a guy, and the guy is Jane Fonda's son, so therefore Jane Fonda is going to become Jennifer Lopez's mother-in-law, but the film's called Monster-in-Law, from which we gather that Jane Fonda's going to be really horrible to her, and that's what happens. Jane Fonda is really horrible because she doesn't want her son to marry Jennifer Lopez. I mean, frankly, who would? It's, you know, it makes perfect sense. And the movie plays out in 90 minutes. It does every single possible mother-in-law horrible gag. And I laughed four times.
Well, now, that's not bad.
It's not bad. I mean, obviously, it's a bad movie. It's badly constructed. It's badly directed. It's badly written. And Jennifer Lopez is complete nonsense in it. But Jane Fonda is perfectly okay. And I did laugh four times, which means it's nothing like the stinker that it could have been. It's no good, but it's not awful.
Philip Bunting says, as another Englishman living abroad, I do get some strange comments from my American wife. She will often inquire to the... This is because we had the reviews from the University of Carolina. She'll often inquire as to the length of the tailbacks on the M1 and the current weather in Scotland. After a while, you kind of blank out the travel. Chicago, by the way, currently 62 degrees overcast. High expected to be 70. Traffic all normal. 22 minutes to downtown from the airport.
Mm.
You have fans around the world. And
that wasn't a fan, that was a travel update.
Counts the same thing, really, okay. If you're desperate. And Paul in Islington in London. Simon and Mark, this is because you talk about bodily response at the cinema.
Okay.
The only bodily response at the cinema I do not understand is when people clap at the end of films. What's that all about? Are they trying to give thanks to the projectionist? Well, if that's your attitude, Paul, don't go and see Star Wars 3 because they applaud at the beginning and at the end.
Yes, well, I was sitting next to Anne V. Coates when they showed The Matrix Revolutions, and she applauded at the end of the chase sequence, but she was applauding the editing, I'm sure. I didn't ask her because it's Anne V. Coates. What am I going to do? It's like, you know, she's a legend.
First time that ever happened, that was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, when people just spontaneously applauded at the end of the movie.
Is that right?
You're not finished yet.
Okay, and very quickly, Friday Night Lights, a sports movie. It's about a college football team's rise to, you know, from nothing up to the championships. Billy Bob Thornton is the coach. Let's very quickly have a quick clip of Billy Bob Thornton urging his team on.
It's a good day, gentlemen. It's a good day to think about responsibility. It's a good day to ask yourself if on a personal level you're willing to accept that. If you're willing to accept the responsibility that you have to protect this team and this school and this town. And make no mistake about it, gentlemen. We are in the business of protecting this town.
So, basically, college team, all the guys have to learn to play together. You know, they've got to put all their stuff behind them. It's all personal. When they get out of there on the field, they've got to fight for everything. They say things like, hey, guys, whatever happens now, I really love you, and all that sort of stuff. It's directed by Peter Berg, as close to an art movie as it is possible for a sports movie to be. You do feel like you've been run down by the opposing team, who batter at the camera. The big guys, you know, American football, like that. It's kind of like what any given Sunday would have been like if it had been directed by Gus Van Sant. It's hyperbolic and it's overblown and all the rest of it, but it's probably as good an American college football movie as you're going to get, but it's not as good as Any Given Sunday.
Movie of the week.
By quite a long way, The Jacket.
Mark, thank you very much indeed. Have a fantastic weekend. We're back on Monday.